stay tuned for The Lynn Show. If you were listening last week, you heard the first half of my interview with the one and only Austin Pendleton, and I know that you're curious to hear the rest of the story, and it is well worth listening to. So hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Knowing thyself. It's all about recognizing that we may be, in fact, I believe most of us are, hiding parts of ourselves, hiding aspects of ourselves, unaware of the fact that we are more than we think we are. I am a psychotherapist. I've been practicing for more than 30 years, and currently my entire practice is on the telephone. That is, people call me, and we do the work of therapy on the telephone. And what I have learned over my many years doing this work is that people come for help. They generally want either to stop doing something they're doing or to start doing something that they're having trouble making themselves do. And ironically, I have seen over and over and over that the problem is not that they have to learn something that they don't know. The problem is that they already have the capacity to do this thing they want to do, or they have the capacity to stop doing what they're doing, but they don't realize it. That, and again, this is my experience. I like to tell my clients, this is the gospel according to Lynn. This is not in any sense the truth, but it is my truth. It is the truth that I have seen proven over and over again. And as I tell my clients, everyone who I talk to has to evaluate what I say, has to take it in and ask themselves, does this ring true for me? Do I believe this? Is this worth considering? Is this worth risking? Because it is a risk. In my experience, what happens is we have a childhood in which something about us doesn't fit what our families want us to be. Or something about us doesn't fit the culture that we're raised in, or the school we attend. And lots of kids have, well, lots of grown-ups have reported to me that when they were kids, they were in some kind of parochial school. And in that school, they were unable to be what they were. If you were listening about a month ago, you heard the interview with the unbelievably talented and remarkable Mary Testa. And she said that she went to a Catholic school. She's Italian. But everything that she was something that was wrong in the eyes of her school. She was Italian, but most of the kids in the school were Irish. She had dark, curly hair, and no one else did. She had big breasts, and the rest of the girls were flat-chested. She was outgoing and bombastic, and the rest of the girls were retiring and polite. And she paid a very big price for simply being wrong. Not that she was wrong or there was anything wrong with her. In fact, she, all those qualities are much to be desired. And she's making a living with some of them. But she's paying the price of having felt bad and wrong about herself. And so there are things that she is unable or unwilling to do, unable or unwilling to risk as a grown-up, because she paid such a heavy price for being thought to be wrong as a child. This Mary described very poignantly, I thought, and very honestly. And perhaps if you listened to her, or if you simply have listened to me recounting what happened to her, you are having flashbacks, memories, that of things that you did or didn't do that somehow didn't go down well. You know, as I'm speaking, I'm remembering that in elementary school, we had a crafts time. And I'm very dyslexic, and so I could not. I couldn't figure out how to do the lanyard. My fingers simply wouldn't do it. And I decided that I had no artistic talent, that I should not risk trying to do anything crafty or artsy, because I didn't have it. I believe now that that was not true. I have got artistic talent. But I was in graduate school before I even got a taste of what that might be. Another class that required me to do some other stuff. And it turned out I could do that stuff really well, some sculpting, which came quite easily and naturally to me. But I had already decided that I didn't have that. That wasn't a part of the package of Lynn. Well, so I'm wondering if, as I am talking, if you are thinking of things that you think about yourself. Do you think that you're shy and simply aren't able to speak up in a group or say what's on your mind, and you're always second-guessing it and wondering how this is going to go down? Or maybe you think that you're, selfish because you want things. And you think that that's a terrible quality. I saw a wonderful woman. I've told this story before, so if you've heard it, I'm sorry. But it's so instructive of how this happens. She was about 4, and her mother took her to a little birthday party for another child, you know, friend. And in this particular birthday party, there were a lot of presents in the middle of the room, and all of the children were entitled to get one. I thought that was a very sweet idea. And the children got numbers, and they were able to go to the pile of presents in the order that they got their numbers. And my client, this little four-year-old, got number one. She was very excited. She leapt up, and she picked up the biggest present. And her mother said instantly, "Put that down. That's not nice to take the biggest present." And that moment, that shame, which she can feel to this day at 45, defined her entire life, her entire ability to want, to go for what she wanted. She's got a life in which she knew what everybody else wanted, what everybody else needed, but not her. And of course, eventually that will turn into resentment or depression, which is why she wound up in my office. Because there was nothing wrong with wanting, and there was nothing wrong with going for the biggest present. But she was told that that was ugly. That was not to be tolerated. The desire to want was not to be tolerated. And so she hid it. Of course, she still was able to want, but she had a, I don't know if you know the term governor. It's an old term used in cars. They put a governor on the gas pedal. So you could only just go so fast. No, the car could go faster, but you could only go just so fast. So she put a governor on what she was willing to allow herself to know that she wanted. So, the Lynn Show is about making this point, about saying there may be, perhaps there is, something about you that you have pretended is not so and then forgot. And if there is, it is my hope that as you listen to the show, and if you're more interested in this, you can learn about this from my book, When You Can, You Will, which is for sale on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Or even think about coming into therapy. There's an article on the website, again, thelynshow.com. It's called Psychotherapy on the Go and explains what it's like to do therapy on the phone. All of those things are on the website, and all of the interviews that I do, and that's the other thing I do with my show. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because in order to dedicate your life in some way to an art, it has to be who you really are. And all of the people that I interview, at least in the area of their work or their avocation, if it's not their life's work, are who they really are. Because you can't do it in our culture. The culture is so hard on art and artists that it has to be integral to you. It has to be a part that you have not denied. And today, I am playing the second part of an interview with a person who knew at the age of 6, having observed rehearsals in the basement, in the living room of his home, as he snuck down with his younger brother to hide in the stairwell and observe, he knew from the moment he saw that, that that was him, that he was it. Now, I'm sorry if you have not gotten an opportunity to listen to the first interview. You might want to go up on my website, thelynshow.com, and listen to Austin's story and the way that he knew from the moment he saw them that acting, that theater, that stories were his life, but was unable to say that out loud in the world, except in his home. And this is no doubt why he was able to hold on to this dream and make it a reality, because he had the support of his home. But in his world, he pretended, he denied, he lied about it. Still, he was able to hold on to it and to pursue it. And I'm going to tell you a story from that earlier, from the first half of the interview, so you will understand it when it comes up in the second half. Austin was accepted into Princeton, where he wanted to go, but he was failing physics. And in his senior year, his physics teacher took him aside and explained that he was failing physics but that the physics teacher was going to give him a C, which he under no circumstances even approached deserving, because if he gave him the grade he deserved, he couldn't go to Princeton. And Austin and I talk about what an extraordinary person that teacher was, and it comes up again later in this interview, so I wanted you to know what he and I were referring to when we talk about that. Listening to Austin is instructive and inspirational and funny. And if you didn't get a chance to listen to the first half, I really suggest you go up on thelinshow.com and listen to it, because it's a treat. And Austin is a person who is so very much himself, so very much who he is. It comes through so loud and so clear and so beautifully. So it's going to sound as though I'm starting in the middle of something, and of course I am. This is the very end of the first interview. Up until now, we've been talking about Austin's childhood and his time in college, and we're picking it up right there. So here, Austin Pendleton. You're in college, and you're writing these things, and you think you're going to be, you know, the next best thing, and then you graduate.
That's right. That's the story of my first 21 years in one very efficient sense.
Thank you very much.
And then you,
and then you graduate. Yeah. Right. And so?
So then I came into New York and I got a leading part in a major show.
So you were right.
Yeah, but it was a whole other, that wasn't what I was planning to do.
Oh, well.
It was this play called Oh Dad, Poor Dad.
Oh, yes. And you're feeling so sad.
And that kid, he stutters. Very badly. Oh. And I remember I read the play and I thought it was printed before it was ever done in New York, which is what's unusual. It still is unusual. And I read it because one had heard about the play. It had this weird title. It had been written by a Harvard undergraduate, Arthur Cobbett, and produced successfully at Harvard, and it snapped up by New York producers and all that. And so one day I was taking the train back to New Haven when I was still in college, and I was in the bookstore at Grand Central, and I picked it up and I read it, and I thought, if I could get an audition at this part, I could get the part.
Yeah.
There was just that.
You're an actor.
I didn't want the part particularly, but I thought it's a big part, which to an actor is no small consideration.
No, and it was a major.
You're on stage
right?
A lot.
Yes.
You know. And then I went away with my friends and some of my family to Europe just after I graduated from Yale. And I came back into New York, and there it said it was being directed by Jerome Robbins.
Good God!
It was the first time he ever had directed a play as opposed to a musical. And I thought, so I went to a couple of agents' offices, and I said, listen, I feel like it.
I could do this.
And they were remarkably patient. They said, what have you done?
Yeah.
Well, I was an apprentice at Williamstown. And I was in all the plays at college. I said, Austin, you're asking us to send you up to audition for Jerome Robbins for a leading role. Yeah, well, look at me, you know. And finally, through an actor.
You know the definition of the word chutzpah?
Yes,
this must have been what they were thinking.
This was, yes, chutzpah. Mm-hmm. And I finally, a friend of mine who had been an actress who had been also an apprentice in Williamstown and gotten an agent, she said, "Larry, I told my agent today," and my agent said, "They can't find what they're looking for Oh Dad." So I told my agent about you, and my agent said, "Have him come in and meet."
Right.
They've seen everybody, and Jerry Robbins isn't pleased yet. And I mean, they saw some of the great young actors of the time. So I thought, I said, "Oh, great, thank you. She said, "Austin, don't," and she, my actress friend on the phone, said, "Austin, don't have the part." This is just a meeting with my agent who may decide to send you the test reader, who may decide to give you an audition for a director who may then decide that,
you know, right.
No, yeah, right, but you know. And I got the part.
Yeah.
I did a great first audition, and Jerry Robbins was knocked out, and then I came back for the second audition, and I totally blew it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know anything about I would get on stage and act, but I didn't know how you held on to something. I didn't know.
You weren't really ever trained as an actor.
Well, we're coming to that.
Ah.
I couldn't get it back. I couldn't get it back. And I saw that Jerry was getting frustrated because he knew I could do
it. Right.
Yeah, but where did it go?
Right.
Yeah. And, then finally I was home for Christmas and the agency called and said, they want you to come back one more time. So I flew back in right after Christmas. And I read opposite Barbara Harris.
Oh, my God.
And we clicked, and we both got the parts that day.
Wow.
And that play made her a star.
Yes.
And
but not you.
And I... No, it didn't make me a star, but it put me in the pool.
That's right.
You know,
right.
I wasn't ready to. But...
But you didn't know it.
That old adage, if God wants to punish you, and he gives you what you want. I couldn't do that year. I could falling apart on stage. I just couldn't. I would lose control of the speech for one thing, because the part himself was a stutterer, and I couldn't shape it. I couldn't. In fact, when we opened, I stayed away from it completely. Jerry kept saying, "Why aren't you stuttering?" It says right, and you do stutter. Why don't you do that? Why don't you use it? I will, Jerry. I will. I will. I will. But I wouldn't go near it. So I didn't open all that effectively in it. I wasn't going into the heart of the...
No, it must have been really scary for you.
Yeah, and so I just decided I'll avoid it, which is, of course, not the actor any actor should ever give to answer any actor.
But you were so young.
Yeah, but still, I was playing a leading role in a long-running play. It was, and the reason it was long-running was because of Barbara Harris, who just took the town by storm. She was breathtaking. And the... And I just couldn't handle it. And I tried to get out of it. I could have gotten out of it. I had a 2-week out, you know, because it was off Broadway. And Jerry said, "No, don't. I can't stop you from going, but you shouldn't go." And I said, "Yeah, but Jerry, you have no idea how bad my performance frequently is." And I said, "Yes, I do. I read the performance reports. I'm telling you, I don't think you should back out. You won't ever act again. First of all, you won't have the nerve to. And secondly, the industry will say, well, you just can't do it, you know. So you just stay in it."
That was another very generous...
That was... even exceeded the physics
teacher. The physics teacher, I was thinking exactly the same thing.
Because Jerry's name...
Because his play was on the line, right? Yeah. The physics teacher didn't keep it.
Sweep it under the rug. But it said, directed by Jerome Robbins, and about maybe a third of the nights, I was just pulling that show. Crashing down, and so I said to one of the actors in it, Barry Primus is his name. He's had a lovely career. He's a terrific actor. But anyway, I said to him, I don't know, this is a nightmare. I don't know what I'm doing. Half the time I'm falling apart on stage, almost literally. I can't. He said, "I'm going to tell you something." I said, "What?" And he gave me the subway directions to HB Studios. He said, "You call up, you make an audition, point me to audition for Uta Hagen.
Right.
And here are the trains you take.
Oh.
Get off the front car and do, you know."
Right.
And so I auditioned for her. So I began that summer to study with her. And that was the first real formal training I ever had. So I began to get a little bit more hold of Odette during the year. I mean, it was a struggle, but I wasn't just completely lost anymore. And then Jerry put me in his next show, which was Fiddler on the Roof.
I see.
Yeah.
It's very cute. You know, you are all but blushing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I still don't believe it. You know? He's out of his mind. But I was more together by the time I got to Fiddler. And that was, of course, I just had a year with Barbara Harris.
Right.
And Joe Van Fleet, by the way.
Yes.
Who was pretty amazing.
Right.
And then, after, you know, like a year and a half, I had a whole year with Zero Mostel.
Right.
Which, like, kicked all the doors open for me. I've never seen such freedom in an actor on stage.
Really?
Oh, God. I mean, there were those who said it again. occasionally became somewhat excessive. But if that was true, and probably was, it was too much of a very, very good thing. And those were almost the two longest times I've ever been in a show, those two shows at Jerry's. I was in Fiddler for the first year of its run, and Odette for almost the whole run, which was a little over a year. And so, and I'm one of the few actors that I know who actually enjoys a long run. Probably because I associate with the struggle that goes on all through the run. So I don't think of it ever going flat.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, that's the trap of the long run. It just starts to get mechanical.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right.
But I'm always afraid that I'm going to be overwhelmed. It goes back to those Odette years. Which,
right.
That feeling of, oh, it's all going to fall apart tomorrow night. And so there's this constant...
So you're always on edge. You're always on edge.
Yeah, yeah. And therefore I like, and in the shows that I've been in since then, which either have... run even longer than that, or almost as long. I have an appetite for that, but it hasn't happened now since the Diary of Anne Frank, 15 years ago or whatever.
Is that because, why is that?
I don't know. Really? I haven't been in a show that's run that long since then.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you sorry?
Oh no, I find ways to fill the time, but but I mean, it's not. I mean, and also I'm. It's a good, I mean, the experience I've had with long runs is terrific because it's always been good material and I've always been on stage with very creative actors. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what it would be like to be stuck for a year in a show you didn't like. Or a part you didn't like. Or actors who were mechanical. I don't know what that would be like.
Forgive me, you don't have to answer anything I ask you, you know.
That's okay.
Well, you don't know yet.
That's true.
But I'm really curious about the stuttering and the...
So am I.
Oh, so you don't know?
I've worked on it. In the very early 1980s, I was in the supermarket and in line, you know, and like we all do, I was reading the magazines while someone was being checked through ahead of me. And there was an article about a program for stuttering in Hollins College in Virginia. So I took down the number and I went home and I called them and I got a time to go down there. First of all those years since Odette and up until the 1980s, just working with very difficult material in acting roles, and you work with speech teachers and voice teachers, and I got a singing teacher and all that. You do a whole lot of exercises that sort of begin to get at that. And then there's always...
Get at that physically?
Yeah.
But not psychologically?
Well, first you have to get at it physically.
Really?
Yeah.
See, I would have thought it was the reverse.
No. All the psychological problems develop around the physical problem.
Oh, see now?
And you get, and then you get overwhelmed when it hits you when you're quite young with a feeling of total helplessness.
Exactly.
Which then reinforces itself.
Forces it. Right.
And,
so you really believe that this is basically a physical thing?
Everyone I know, every teacher I've known who has addressed the problem at all, it's not. It's a weird intertwined mixture of a physical thing and an emotional thing, but the physical aspect of it becomes so aggressive and becomes a kind of neurological habit.
It's a feedback loop. It triggers itself.
Yeah, and it starts to, and then it. It affects the breathing, and then the breathing
affects
it. And
right, and then you're off and running, and you can't control it.
Yeah, and if you just start to, you can't go in and untie all the knots, but you have to untie kind of a single knot and hope that
that will lead to the
loosening of all the other knots. And one that you can actually do some work on, although it's very hard, it's a very long thing to do, is the sheer physicality of the problem.
Okay, so then what you're saying, which is the opposite of what I would have thought, is that the...
It's the opposite of what I would have thought, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's interesting. So the psychological problems that you're talking about come from the feeling of helplessness, the feeling of being out of control.
But they also help to create it.
Yeah, right. Right.
But you can't go back to the moment it was created psychologically. I mean, you can go back and kind of find out what it was. But
does that mean you did?
No, I've never really done that. I mean, I know all about it, but I...
You do?
Yeah, it's stuff that went down. But the but it's so hard.
Wait!
No,
you don't have to tell me. But how do you know?
People told me.
How old were you?
7.
Right around the time with the theater.
Yeah, but it was other stuff.
I'm sure.
Yeah. In fact, probably the reaction to the theater happened of seeing A Way Out.
A Way Out. Yeah.
But anyway, but you hear about this stuff, and I'm sure it's all important, but other people go through the same things, and they don't start. Oh, also, a lot of kids start to stutter, and statistically, all the statistics about stuttering are true worldwide to an uncanny degree.
So it doesn't matter what language, matter what culture.
Yeah.
Right, wow.
They're incredibly the same. And one of them is that, you know, there are a whole lot of kids who have trouble with that when they're kids. And then when they turn to a teenager, it either evaporates, sometimes literally.
Just disappears.
Or it gets much worse. 3/4 of the time it evaporates. The other 1/4 of the time it suddenly gets worse, which is what happened to
you. And do they have any idea? What does the what?
No.
Wow.
Even the most sophisticated. It's a very tangled web. And often, by the time people can identify it as a problem,
it's already installed.
It's entered the nervous system.
Right, I got it.
It's very
right.
And so, but anyway, so I called them at Hollins and I said, I'd like to have it's a 3-week thing, very intensive, and then you have to, after that, for years, you practice, you go back for refreshers, they give you exercise books and all that. And then I found I couldn't go to Virginia, because I got hired to direct Elizabeth Taylor in The Little Foxes. It would have been the 3 weeks right before we went into rehearsal,
right.
And that just wouldn't have been a good idea. So I called them and said, well, we have a play. They said, are you calling from New York? And I said, yeah. We have a play. We just opened a place in New York. So I went there for those 3 weeks. And that really began. Now, for 20 years leading up to that, I've been doing okay because of this.
Because you're
all the work with voice teachers and all the work
because you work you're like right, you work very hard.
Yeah, and
but you're not intense.
Everybody is intense.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And so then that got it down to a set of things I could specifically work from.
So they have a program of stuff that you do.
Yeah, and it's very detailed, and it's very specific. And the article about it that I read in People magazine, the trigger of the article was that woman, Annie Glenn, you know, she's the wife of John Glenn,
yes.
The astronaut, and then he was a senator from Ohio. And I remember that I would read about Annie Glenn when I was younger. She was the first astronaut to go around the Earth. And they all came to her front lawn in Columbus, Ohio and she was too afraid to come out on the lawn to speak to them.
Mm-hmm. I remember this,
yeah.
Actually.
And then she had tried everything, and then she heard about this program in Hollins, and she went, and she was now going around the country giving speeches. and so in the aftermath of when I was in the program, I met Annie and John Glenn.
Oh, my.
Oh, and a couple times we had dinner and when they would be in New York. Fantastic woman. I mean, she had a more severe problem than I did.
Wow.
And when I had it, which was the peak, which was the teenage years, I was pretty bad. But she was worse, and she was an adult. Mm-hmm. And she was raising kids.
Kids, right.
And was the wife of a man who
was famous.
was famous and then became a politician.
Ay, ay, ay.
And she's just fantastic. Well, he's fantastic too. And anyway, so so that was great. She was the only other person I'd ever really talked to where we'd been through some through two completely different versions of the same trip.
Well, and actually, both of you had the desire to or the need to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So the motivation was pretty much identical, right?
Yeah. And but so, and you don't ever get, as you probably know this already, you don't get completely rid of it ever. But you just learn all kinds of techniques to control it, and then that relaxes you about it.
Right, and then it's less.
One by one, a lot of the knots begin to untie, and it doesn't affect your relationship so much because you're not defensive about it anymore because you're doing it much less.
And you're not worried about it all the time.
And you're not worried about it all. It is the kind of thing when, in the earlier days, you think about it every minute.
Yeah, right. Is it going to happen now?
Yeah, it's going to happen. And then that begins to relax. I mean, you finally say, yeah, it's going to happen some, but I don't care anymore. And then that, in turn, relaxes things and keeps it from... And I'm sure it's hurt my career, and being in My Cousin Vinny didn't help.
Because
it was the dirty secret of the industry. Everybody knew I had a slight problem with this.
Right.
But My Cousin Vinny, I was just flaunting it.
Yeah.
All because of two bottles of Ritzita. Ah, yeah. And the director, when he saw what a success the film was, he's my friend. He said, oh my God, I didn't mean to get you typed this way. And he started to put me in a whole lot of others of his movies. Some great roles, by the way.
What?
Oh, I think my favorite is one called Trial and Error, where I play the judge. And I love that movie. And it's a great role.
I don't think I've seen it.
Oh, it's marvelous. I'm good. I do think I'm good in that. And but so everybody else. Rip Torn in it.
Oh, Rip
is
Torn.
Inspired. I mean, he's just inspired. There are a lot of good things in that movie. Mm-hmm. And but the hit was My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah, sure.
And so that it. I mean, I'm not sad I did it, but it didn't help. I mean, you know. It's fine.
And anyway, it's water under the bridge.
It's fine, and life goes on.
And
I mean, it does. It's really not terrible to have been one of the most beloved movies of the last 50 years.
And have people stop you on the street and take your picture.
Yeah, you can't legitimately complain about that. And the
well, yeah, you can, but all right.
Yeah, all right.
Right.
And I mean, as soon as you start that, you can get into your whole career. We'll put aside your life. You can get just into your whole career, and once you start to figure, if only.
So, if someone were not to know you and to ask you what you did, what would you say?
I'd say I'm in theater and film.
I'm in theater and film.
In the theater, I'm an actor, a director, and a playwright, and a teacher of acting. And I've even been kind of a producer. I mean, twice in my life, I've been either the artistic director or one of the three artistic directors of the theater, each time in a period of transition for the theater. And so effectively that means you're a producer. Mm-hmm. So I've done that, but I wouldn't do that again. I don't really think I would do that again. I don't enjoy it that much.
It's not creative enough?
It's extremely creative in its own way, but it's exhausting to me. I mean, there are people who do that very well.
Right, and it feeds them, but it doesn't feed you.
No, it's you learn a lot, and you have interesting experiences in it. But it's like...
But who cares?
Okay, I get it now.
I got that, right.
I get it now.
Right, I don't feel like I got everything I need to get from that.
It's made me somewhat more cooperative when I'm working under an artist.
I'll bet it does.
Well, like, I became, I think, somewhat easier to direct after I became a director. As an actor.
It's always easier when you've been on the other side.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, I was impossible when I was an actor before I became...
Really?
Oh, yeah. I was temperamental. I was, you know. That stopped after the first show I ever directed. People would be, I said, what are they doing? What are they doing to me? And then I realized they're doing exactly to me what I've done. That's what they're doing.
Turn about.
I get it. I see. All right. I get it.
Do you know why you were?
Oh, the reason any actor gets to me, I would get frightened.
Ah, yes.
It's very frightening being an actor.
I know.
And that doesn't go away. In fact, when it begins to go away, you should stop acting.
That's what they say, but I'm not sure I really understand that.
Who wants to see an actor who's totally at ease? It's like, well, yeah, he's like serving hors d'oeuvres. I mean, what? Sometimes I feel I get on 3 subways, say, to go see a play, and I'm a little bit late and pressed for time, and I rush, and I get there, and I pick up my ticket, and I run, collapse and see just as it begins, and it's been the last half hour, 45 minutes, has been more stressful. And I look at these actors who are enacting these plays.
Yeah, who are phoning it in.
Yeah, and I said, it's easier for them than it was for me to get... And suddenly the whole story of the play gets flattened out. See, I grew up when actors were crazy.
Crazy?
Oh, yeah, like some of the people I've named to you.
Right.
And also, I mean, Kim Stanley was the greatest actress I ever saw in my life. And people like that. And you knew it was costing them. And I mean, and extraordinary things would come out of that. You know, Jason Robards,
yes.
People like that, and Jill Van Fleet, mm-hmm. and Barbara Harris,
mm-hmm.
and Zero in his own way.
Right.
That was all coming out of someplace.
You know, I heard a story. Mm-hmm. I think it was Bert Lahr, but it might have been Zero. He did some bit in a rehearsal. And everybody broke up. They were hysterical. And he said, what are you laughing at?
Yeah.
Serious.
I know.
Because he was so in it.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
That kind of thing. Now, we still have that. You
right.
see actors who do that. But they're usually edgy people. And you don't ever want to get completely on top of it.
So do you think you're an edgy person?
I am when I'm acting a role, yeah. I'm scared all the time. Now, I used to be terrified all the time. I'm not now, well, I'll say that, but I'm not, I mean, I used to be like primal terror.
And what do you do with that?
You put it into the role. If the play is interesting at all, the character is terrified of something.
Right.
Well, there wouldn't be a story.
Right.
So you just put it into it. There's a whole set of techniques for that.
And which you now know and teach.
I learned them from Uta Hagen and from Robert Lewis. He was another acting teacher of mine. He was also a Broadway director and a director and a very fine one. And Uta was, of course, herself a great actress. One of the really great actors. And so they taught what they knew. And in rehearsal, you always feel if you find something you're going to lose it.
Yes.
And from
wow.
Yeah, and it's not just a thing where, except some people do turn into this a thing where you work it all out and you can make your peace with it and you just go on stage and frankly that's not all that interesting to watch.
Not boring.
Sometimes it's fun to watch, kind of. But it's not electrifying, whether it's a comedy or a tragedy or whatever it is. It's not that. You forget it as soon as you're watching. And you know, some people today, they talk, I don't want to hire that actor because they're difficult to work with. And it's like, what profession are we in?
Yeah.
What do you think, you know? Who cares? And Jerry Robbins, I learned that from. I would hear people say, don't cast him, don't cast her. They're temperamental, they're difficult. And he'd go, yeah, but they're the best one for the part.
Right.
And he took these people on, and they would fight with him. But extraordinary things would happen. So that happened in each of the 2 shows that I did with him. Particularly Joanne Fleet with Odette. But, boy, she was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And Zero and you, I get odds from day one.
Really?
Well, they had a political history about the naming of names to the House. House and the Marine. But also even apart from that, just the way in which they worked was so radically different from each other. But that friction created something just really astounding in that show. And as with Jo Van Fleet, it was like terrifying what she did. She would get to the theater every day at 4:30, every day for a year.
Wow.
Yeah. She was in for the long haul, you know. And she wouldn't be, I mean, they didn't exist then, but it wasn't, she wouldn't be on her cell phone until the place is called.
Yeah, right.
You know, and there's some pressure that creates this work. And some of that pressure is composed of, like, fear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, plays are about fear.
Yes.
If they're not, they don't work.
Yes, right.
They're just not engaging to watch.
There's no action.
Yeah, there's no trouble.
Right. There's no conflict.
Yeah.
Right.
There's
nothing to resolve.
There's no importance to any of the characters of anything that's going on.
Right.
Why should be of any importance? The audience doesn't have to sympathize with the characters, but they need to take in what the character is going through. And therefore that has to happen.
Yes.
And I mean, Olivier would get so upset. He would have a brilliant night and the cast would applaud him as he walked to his dressing room, and he would slam the door and somebody would come in, "What is it?" And they'd go and say, "Well, we just want to know, why are you so upset? We thought you were breathtaking tonight." "I'll tell you why I'm upset. I have no idea how I did it."
Yeah, right.
"And I have to do it again tomorrow." That's legitimate.
Yeah.
You know, and then you would see him on a good night. I'm sure if you saw him on a bad night, but I saw him on some good nights. Olivier, oh my God, I still remember everything he did, and it, you know. So I remember this too. I've worked a few times with Alan Arkin. He directed me in a Broadway show in the 60s, and then I was in three movies with him. And in and around that, I've kind of known him on and off for years.
Right.
And he wrote a book that came out maybe a year ago or something like that, or over a year. And so I emailed him and I told him how much I liked the book. And he wrote me.
What was the book? Do you remember?
Oh, God. An Improvised Life.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
I think that's the title, but mm-hmm. Just say it. Put it.
Alan Arkin.
And the title is... Well, even if that isn't the title, related to the title, it's a book that came out maybe a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And it's a wonderful book. And I saw him email him about it, and I went on about how I liked it, and he emailed me back very, very, very graciously about that. And then we just started emailing for a little bit, and I said, you know, at that time he would hang out around Baudet all the time. He was kind of involved with Barbara Harris for a little while. He'd hang out backstage and show him play his guitar. And and one time we were all waiting for the bus, the crosstown bus after the show. And he said, "Hey, Austin." And I was in awe of him. I'd seen some of the stuff he'd done at Second City with Barbara Harris, and I was in awe of him. He said, hey man, you know, I watched you again tonight. You've gotten much better." And I thought, he's insane, because this was when I was beginning to sort of lose control of my mm-hmm. voice. And I said, "Thank you," but I thought privately, he's out of his mind.
Right.
He's either being stupidly generous or he doesn't know what he's looking at. And it took me years to figure out. Now, he was telling me something. Because Barbara knew that I was in trouble, although I must say, she's the most generous stage partner in the world. I mean, and she probably had talked to Alan about it. And what he was trying to say to me, consciously, was, "No, you're allowing some of the trouble in. It's affecting the whole performance in a way that's very good."
Yes.
And of course, I wasn't ready to hear that then. And just over the years, and I don't just mean that kind of trouble. But that's related to a lot of other kinds of trouble. It's like, no, you've gotta surf the real trouble, not just ice skate on top of it, you know.
That's a lovely image.
Yeah, and so I emailed all this to him, like, you know, these emails we did about a year and a half ago. And he said, wow, I said that? Yeah, you think you say all these profound things to people that change their lives and everything, and then you remind them of it years later and they don't even know what you're talking about. I don't even remember saying that to you. It's very funny. And I think it's gone a long way toward changing my life, actually. That one moment. I remember the corner we were on.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's lovely to have been able to give that back to him.
Yes, it did. It felt very lovely.
Mm-hmm,
I suddenly became aware, because his book is so open about him and acting and all that, that it reminded me of that moment. I'd sort of forgotten about it. But over the years, I would think about it often, but then I was in a period when I forgot about it.
Do you want to say anything about what you're doing now?
Now I've been out of town for months. I directed a play in London, and I directed a play in Little Rock. And then I directed an opera in Boston, so I've been away a lot. But now I'm back into teaching, and now I'm working as a director / as a teacher on some student-related projects at HP, productions that will be done outside of HP, but they're all HP people. And HP is where I teach, HP Studio, where at Udall.
Where you learned.
To which I learned the subway directions from very far. And so I'm working on three of those right now. All of them very difficult plays. Then in about a month, I'm going to direct, there's a theater in New York called CSC, Classic Stage Company, and over the past 3 years I've directed two Chekhov plays there, one Uncle Vanya and one Three Sisters, with people like Peter Sarsgaard and Maggie Gyllenhaal and other good people. And this fall we're going to do a more obscure Chekhov play called Ivanov.
Ivanov.
Yeah. It's about a play about a man who's terminally depressed.
Mm.
It's a challenging play. I mean, it's a wonderful play. It's by Chekhov, but it's really tough.
You're going to direct. You're not going to be Ivanov.
I once acted one of the other leading roles in the same play at the Yale Rep. It was directed by the then artistic director of the Moscow Art Theater, who did not speak a word of English. One of the most enchanting men I have ever met. He would arrive slightly, he'd had a few drinks by the beginning of rehearsal each morning. He'd sit there with a grin. He would speak in English and he'd watch him. And he'd go, Niet, Niet, Niet. And then he would act it all out in Russian. And somehow you knew exactly what he wanted to do in English. And it was a thrilling play to work on. Ivanov himself was played by William Hurt.
Oh, yes.
He's something else.
No kidding.
He's fantastic. Here it's going to be Ethan Hawke.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
So when is this?
It starts previews in mid-October. I got to go now, unfortunately. This is fun.
This was amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is a real pleasure.
If you'd never heard of Austin Pendleton before, and I'm always surprised that so many people have not, perhaps having listened to this interview, you are surprised that you have not. Certainly you've seen movies that Austin has been in. You may have seen plays that he's either been in or directed. You've certainly seen people who have worked with him, who admire him. If you were listening to the first interview, you heard me talk about the Austin Pendleton Project, which two young men have put together. And it is a film which I believe is designed to introduce Austin to a wider audience. And they have a Kickstarter, I don't know what you call those. They have put together a Kickstarter in an attempt to raise some money to finish the film. In my first interview, I played a little section from the film of Meryl Streep and Olympia Dukakis talking about Austin. The film, of course, has many, many, many more famous and well-respected actors, directors, playwrights talking about Austin. and these two young men need a little bit more money to finish the film. If you go up to my website, thelinshow.com, and you'll see Austin's interview up there, you will also see a link to the Kickstarter video. And you can watch it, and you can donate $5 or whatever you want to help these guys finish the Austin Pendleton project, and maybe Austin will finally get the recognition that he deserves. So, I need to say now what I say at the end of every show, and that is a huge thank you to the remarkable Josh Hackney, without whom I could do nothing. Josh, who is my IT guru and who knows whatever it is that I need to know about whatever it is that I need to do, and who is not only talented and skilled, but generous and kind. I think that's a remarkable combination. If you have needs, electronic, computer, recording, I like to say anything with a plug, you know, Josh can fix it, tell you what to do with it. And you can get him, guess where? At my website, thelinshow.com. So, go up on that if you have interest either in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, Going Into Therapy on the Telephone, listening to any of my interviews, or if you like the song that opens and the song that closes the show, they are on my CD, and that's also on my website. So, and if you have anything you want to say to me about the shows, any questions you want to ask me, any criticisms you want to level at me, there's a place to contact me on the website as well. And I look forward to hearing from you, as always. And, as always, I hope that you got something from this show that you can use. I'm sure that you got something that amused you, that intrigued you, maybe inspired you. I hope that whatever it is you got will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, pal, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got the limper, but I won't go with the wind.
I see your face appearing like an unexpected song, an unexpected song that only we are hearing. I don't know what's going on, can't work it out at all. Whatever made you choose me, I just can't believe my eyes. You look at me as though you couldn't bear to lose me. Now no matter where I am, no matter what I do, I see your face appearing like an unexpected song, an unexpected song that only we are hearing. I have never felt like this. For once I'm lost for words. Your smile has really thrown me, and this is not like me at all. I never thought I'd know the kind of love you've shown me. Now no matter where I am, no matter what I do, I see your face appearing like an unexpected song, an unexpected song that only we are hearing. Like an unexpected song, an unexpected song.